I want to welcome here everyone here this afternoon. This is the Court of Appeals sitting in Denton County. We're happy to be here today. Before I begin, I do want to extend my gratitude to our own Justice Lee Gabriel, who helped coordinate our coming here, along with Katie McFarland, who's the Executive Director of your Denton Bar Association. I also want to extend my gratitude to Judge Tiffany Hartling, whose court we're using today. She can't be here, but she was very gracious in allowing us to use her facilities. And of course, these are the Denton County facilities, so I also want to thank Denton County itself. Allie Silva, who is Judge Hartling's administrator, also was very helpful, as was Sandra Hardy. And of course, nothing runs without the IT department, so I want to thank Larry Harbor as well for facilitating this. We're here this afternoon to hear two oral arguments in two cases. We have a third case on the docket, but it's going to be submitted without argument today. I see that the attorneys are lined up for the first one, but before we begin, I want to introduce the panel. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and to my left is Justice Mark Pittman, and I'm Bonnie Sutters. I'm a justice on the court as well. So if everyone's ready, if the clerk would call the case.
The court will now call D'Amico Stanley versus the State of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Chris Abel will argue for the appellant. Mr. Matthew J. Whitten will argue for the state.
May it please the court, counsel. Justice, thank you for coming to Denton today. I appreciate it. We have free parking, so that's always a bonus for me when you come up, so thank you very much for that. My name is Chris Abel. I'm from Flower Mound. I represent D'Amico Stanley, who was convicted of murder. Originally, Mr. Stanley was charged with capital murder. It proceeded to trial, and the jury found him guilty of the lesser included offense of murder and sentenced him to 75 years. Mr. Stanley was a drug dealer. The victim of this case was also in that same line of business, and this was the stereotypical drug deal that went bad. Mr. Stanley did show up to arrange for the purchase of some marijuana. He showed up. Ultimately, Mr. Miles, who was party to that transaction as well, was shot and killed by Mr. Stanley. And several things occurred at trial, which is why we're here today to ask for relief. Turning to a couple of my first points, I'd like to focus on the jury charge, if we could, because I have several issues related to jury charge error, and then maybe move into some other points as well. There was testimony that came out and evidence submitted before the jury, primarily consisting of my client's statements that were given to the Louisville Police Department after his arrest. Mr. Stanley was arrested in Louisiana and then transported back to Louisville. He gave a lot of statements in that long car ride that were recorded on camera. And then back at the Louisville Police Department, he was interrogated. He submitted to that interrogation and gave statements as well. That was a video that was submitted into evidence during the case. In that video, my client tells the Louisville Police Department basically what happened during this drug transaction and what went wrong. And he stated at one point in time to the detectives that he never intended to kill Mr. Miles, that he was there and felt that he was being set up and that he was going to be robbed. And ultimately, he pulled out his .45 caliber handgun to defend himself in that regard. The gun went off accidentally. And then he started shooting. But he told the detectives, I never meant to kill anyone. I never intended to hurt Mr. Miles. I was trying to defend myself. I didn't mean to kill him. And the detective made a statement, also submitted into evidence via that video, that I believe that you did not intend to kill anybody, and you're probably going to get a manslaughter charge out of this. That was pretty much the crux of the evidence with regards to a potential lesser included manslaughter charge. Later on in the case, trial counsel requested that the court submit an instruction to the jury in the court's charge regarding a lesser included offense of manslaughter, which the Court of Criminal Appeals and most courts have held that manslaughter is indeed a lesser included offense for murder. That instruction was denied by the trial court, which is a main bone of contention on this appeal as to whether or not that denial was proper. Now, if we turn to basically what is required for a defendant to receive a lesser included instruction to the jury, it is simply a scintilla of evidence. The Hall case outlined that by the Court of Criminal Appeals back in 07, that simply a scintilla is enough for the state, or excuse me, for the defense to get a jury instruction. And if we look at the record as a whole, we can clearly see there's more than that scintilla there. based on the defendant's statements that he acted in the way he did, that he basically recklessly took the life of Mr. Miles. There is that scintilla of evidence to substantiate a manslaughter. The detective's statements to him that you're probably going to get a manslaughter out of this is more than a scintilla. Whether or not it's believable by the trier of fact doesn't matter much in our analysis of whether he's entitled to that instruction. It's a jury issue. And the state points out in their brief that they believe that manslaughter would be inappropriate here because my client fired the gun at least four times.
Counsel, what's your best case, in your opinion, for your proposition that the manslaughter instruction should have been given?
Best case is that, do you mean best case as precedent or best case outcome here?
Best case cited in your brief.
I believe the Hall case is pretty good. It talks about how there only needs to be one simple scintilla of evidence for someone to receive a favorable jury instruction in the regard, and that whether or not it's ultimately believable by the trier of fact is a fact issue for the jury to decide, and that it should be given. The Cavazos case also talked about there being a lesser included instruction for manslaughter in a murder charge. So I believe that both those cases tend to show that Mr. Stanley was entitled to this instruction based on the evidence on the record. It was up to the jury to make that determination, whether his version of events was believable.
Isn't that contradictory, though, to the invocation of the self-defense argument?
No,
because
Your Honor.
In order to invoke self-defense, isn't that confession and avoidance? In other words, didn't he admit then that he acted intentionally?
He did admit to his actions, and he admitted that he pulled the gun out. It was kind of equivocating a little bit there, because he said he pulled the gun out, he pulled it out with his left hand instead of a right hand, and he's right-handed, so it was a very reckless fashion how he pulled it out, and he said the first shot was purely accidental. After that, everything happened so quickly, but he did indeed fire several other shots, and Mr. Miles got hit four times. But, I mean, there's case law on point that says that manslaughter, lesser-included manslaughter instruction, is not mutually exclusive of a self-defense claim as well. And for that proposition, I'd cite Alonzo v. State, Court of Criminal Appeals opinion from 2011. In that case, Mr. Alonzo was in a prison fight. He said that the victim in that case was attacking him with a metal spike. They struggled. The victim was ultimately stabbed in the chest with a metal spike. Mr. Alonzo went to trial on a murder charge. They found him guilty of manslaughter, lesser. The jury had sent out notes saying, there's a self-defense instruction in here. I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember the exact words, but they said, dear judge, there's a self-defense instruction here. Does that apply only to the murder charge? And the trial court said, yes, it only applies to the murder charge, not the lesser included manslaughter. And the Court of Criminal Appeals said that was error, that basically it should apply to everything charged.
It was error in the way the court responded to the jury note.
Yes, Your Honor.
But didn't the Alonzo court also say that they did not call the cases into question that say that you don't get a lesser included when you have self-defense? Didn't it later in that opinion say we're not going to take a position here on whether or not we're going to overrule those cases that are out there that say you don't get the manslaughter when you've raised self-defense?
I don't recall that in the opinion. I'd have to reread it. What I recall in that opinion was the court taking issue with the fact that if they bought into the state's line of argument on that appeal in Alonzo, that it would leave open a prosecutorial tactic wherein they could always charge a lesser offense such as manslaughter as count two and thereby preclude any self-defense argument.
Right.
And I remember the court saying specifically, we don't want that to happen in the future. So I don't believe that simply saying I did this in a manner of self-defense precludes one from also saying, but I believe it was reckless and it could be a manslaughter as opposed to an intentional act.
The state makes quite an issue in their brief of the fact that the victim in this case was shot four times.
Yes, sir.
And given the number of shots, that would conclusively show that your client was not acting recklessly. How do you respond to that?
I would respond that that is an issue we don't know because it wasn't submitted to the trier of fact. All that was needed here was a scintilla of evidence to get that lesser included instruction. If ultimately the jury decided against that, then my client would have had his fair shot in court.
And in your contention, the scintilla is, the statements made in the van to the officers as he was coming back from New Orleans, correct?
Yes, sir. That and his interrogation.
Interrogation.
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, sir. His statements on those videos, both to the officers en route from Louisiana to Texas, his statements there in the Louisville Police Department at that jail when he's being interrogated by the detectives, and also the detective's statements to him, which came into evidence as well. I believe that's a scintilla of evidence. All of that would say to the say that there's enough here to warrant an instruction to the jury, to at least let them consider this issue. If ultimately they buy into it, he's a man, he gets convicted of manslaughter. If they don't, he's at least had his fair shot in court with that argument. And that would be my argument there, is that if a jury, I can see a set of circumstances where four shots could still be reckless. Maybe that jury can as well, but we won't know because they weren't submitted here. That question was never given. But if we turn to other issues with regards to the court's charge, my client also requested a defense of property instruction and was denied that as well. Basically, his statements, again, en route from Louisiana to Texas, and then again at the interrogation of Louisville Police Department, were that he believed he was going to get robbed. He thought he had been set up. And so a request for defense of property instruction was made, improperly made, by trial counsel. However, that was denied as well. But again, the same line of reasoning that we have for a manslaughter instruction with regards to a scintilla of evidence being all that's required, that's all that's needed under the Hall case. He presented a scintilla of evidence. In fact, it was presented by the state in that confession tape, where he talks about the fear that he had of being robbed and that he needed to protect his property, protect himself. We know under the penal code that if one reasonably believes deadly force is necessary to prevent a robbery, then it's available as a defense. But he was deprived of that defense and the ability to argue it to a jury, thereby preventing him from having a fair trial. So we also believe that was an issue with the trial court's jury charge. If we turn to punishment, once he's convicted of the lesser included murder as opposed to capital murder, which would tend to show that the jury had some doubt as to whether or not a robbery was actually intended or committed. Once he's convicted, we turn to the punishment phase of trial, wherein he also requested a sudden passion instruction by way of mitigation for his offense. When he asked for a sudden passion instruction, he was denied that instruction. And that would have reduced his potential punishment range and put him in a different category. The sudden passion instruction is an interesting one. There's a lot of cases, the one from Fort Worth being the Trevino case, wherein the court held that most of the time in self-defense cases, a sudden passion instruction and punishment is proper and adequate. The court should do that. There are several other courts of appeals that have held the same line of reasoning applies. And here we have a self-defense case, a self-defense charge that was given to the court, given to the jury by the trial court.
Well, what was the evidence of the sudden passion?
Basically the fact that he feared for the robbery at that point in time. Sudden passion would be any passion directly caused by arising out of provocation. And here he didn't testify, but in that evidence that was submitted in the video, he says that basically, I thought I was getting robbed because this gentleman put his hand on me, these are two guys on me, and I feel like I'm gonna get robbed. So he's under this influence, basically, without time to reflect or pause or cool off, the sudden passion being the terror that he feels for an aggravated robbery that could occur, which also ties into why he probably should have been given the defense of property instruction as well to prevent an aggravated robbery, which he believed he was under the stress of. So we believe he should have been given a sudden passion instruction. We think that goes hand in hand with the self-defense claim as well. Since the self-defense claim was given and was proper in the court's jury charge of guilt innocence, we believe that the sudden passion instruction should have been there too. He was certainly under this terror, this fear of a robbery, this fear of a potential assault on his person, the fear of the robbery of his property. And therefore we believe that that strikes a chord with the sudden passion instruction. Compounding those errors in the charge, especially in punishment, there was additional evidence presented in punishment of an extraneous nature, which we believe was clearly improper as well. During the punishment phase of trial, the state elicited testimony that my client had previously assaulted someone named Mr. Hatz. Mr. Hatz was suffering from a heart condition of some kind. My client struck Mr. Hatz. Mr. Hatz shortly thereafter went into cardiac arrest and died 4 days later. My client was originally arrested for murder with the Hatz case, then indicted for aggravated assault causing serious bodily injury. He proceeded to trial on that years ago and was convicted only of the lesser included misdemeanor assault charge and sentenced to county jail. At trial, the state elicited testimony regarding Mr. Hatz dying shortly after the assault, a few days later, 3 days, maybe four. They also put into evidence the judgment, which stated that he was convicted of a lesser included assault, thereby informing the jury that he had been charged originally with something greater. We believe that was improper because it was extraneous in nature. While extraneous offenses, and even those which are unadjudicated, while those are allowed to be presented to a fact finder in sentencing, if they're relevant, we don't believe that this was relevant. We also don't believe that they were proven beyond a reasonable doubt. In fact, the state had its chance to prove that my client caused Mr. Hatt's death years ago. They had their chance. They went forward on that case under an aggravated assault theory, and they ultimately did not prevail. A fact finder, a jury in that case, found him guilty of the lesser offense. To inform this jury now, or insinuate somehow, that because of the assault Mr. Hatt's died, is basically to say that, hey, Mr. Stanley didn't just kill Mr. Miles. He's killed other people in the past, too. We believe that is highly irrelevant, highly prejudicial. So under 403, it shouldn't apply. And it shouldn't come in under the 3707 because it wasn't proved beyond a reasonable doubt. It was completely unnecessary. If they wanted to explain why Mr. Hatt couldn't be in trial, they could have just said that happened years ago and Mr. Hatt is subsequently deceased. They didn't need his testimony anyway. They didn't need that testimony regarding that at all. And we believe that that judgment should have been redacted to simply reflect a misdemeanor assault, not reference to a lesser included assault. And any testimony regarding Mr. Hatt dying a few days after my client hitting him was completely prejudicial. So much so that it should warrant at least a new punishment trial. For those reasons and for the others that are outlined in my brief, Your Honors, we believe that Mr. Stanley is worthy of a new trial. We would hope that you sustain that argument. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to begin with addressing the issues that Mr. Abel has addressed here. And I'd like to talk about these jury charge issues to expand on the idea of the harm analysis in that may need to be undertaken if, in fact, there was error. I believe that the briefing in the case has explained why we believe there was no error. But beginning with the manslaughter charge, appellant's entire case, entire theory of the case, was one of self-defense. That was how the trial went. And manslaughter requires recklessness and a conscious disregard of an unjustifiable risk that death would occur to the person he shot. Well, the defense of an unjustifiable risk seems to the state that it's the opposite, almost, of a self-defense claim, which is why there's a line of cases discussing that issue. A self-defense claim is one as a justification defense. I was justified in shooting Mr. Miles because I believed I was being set up or robbed. And so there's no rational juror that could have found, had the instruction been given, that manslaughter would have occurred and not the murder. Appellant did fire his gun four times, and despite any statement he may have made to the police about the first shot perhaps being an accident or something like that, there's no evidence, none, that the other three shots were, in fact, an accident. And two people did get shot. He argued those as self-defense claims. With respect to the defense of property type of claim, robbery is a theft plus assault. And the appellant told the police, well, I was afraid I was being set up. I was afraid I was being robbed. But that is not a scintilla that would lead us to think a theft or assault is being occurred. But even if it was, his own statements contradict and would not have allowed a jury, a rational jury, to find defense of property. And it kind of goes hand in hand with the self-defense claim as with the sudden passion type claims as well. A jury rejected his self-defense claim, and it seems highly likely, in fact almost certain, that they also would have rejected the defense of property claim for the same reasons, which would lead us to say that even if that charge should have been given to the jury, no harm occurred. On the punishment issues, sudden passion requires an immediate influence and an adequate cause. There's no harm even if that instruction should have been given. There's Wooten, the Court of Criminal Appeals, analyzed this very thing, that when a self-defense claim during guilt innocence was rejected by the jury, then it was not harmful when a court refused to give the sudden passion instruction. There's no legally adequate cause here in any event. In Wooten, or in the Trevino case upon which the appellant relies, this court found an adequate cause, but in that case, the person who ultimately died did in fact pull a gun. Here, the appellant had told the police, no, Mr. Miles didn't have a gun. He never pulled a gun on me. The most that Mr. Miles may have done, according to appellant, was touch him on the shoulder or something like that, or grab him by the shoulder. And the jury rejected that claim as a self-defense claim. And the standard is one of an ordinary person, not a case like here, where even if appellant is believed that the first shot was accidental or something like that, those aren't the actions of an ordinary person. With respect to the claim about Mr. Hatz, it's important to remember that 3707 gives a trial court wide latitude, a wide berth, to admit any evidence that it deems relevant to sentencing. Mr. Hatz was not available to testify, and as a matter of good trial practice, good prosecution policy, was necessary to explain why. The state never tried to prove up a murder case here. They proved up the assault case. They entered that judgment in, and only one question, I believe, was elicited through testimony about why Mr. Hatz wasn't there. The question was asked, do you know what happened to him after you visited him in the hospital? Yes, he died a few days later. Paraphrasing, but that's the only testimony that came out about that. The state never aimed to try and prove that Mr. Stanley was the cause of that death, and it was always clear to the jury there was never any evidence before the jury that Mr. Stanley had originally been charged with murder in that case. But even if it was error to admit that, no harm occurred. Mr. Stanley has a history of other violent acts. In fact, the enhancement paragraph in this case was for a different aggravated assault that he had committed. There was also testimony about his history of family violence and spitting on a jailer. So this was one piece of a much larger puzzle, this evidence about Mr. Hatz. It was one question, and so even if it should not have come in, it can't be said that this caused harm to the appellant. Would like to touch on one other issue that the appellant has raised, his issue regarding the matter of autopsy photographs and the deceased child being in the apartment at the time of the murder. The evidence about the child being in the apartment was not properly preserved for review. There were a number of questions that were asked before any objection was made, and that information came out through another witness, a neighbor, Turnbow, who said that he was taking care of the child after the shooting when the police were securing the scene and so forth. But even if it shouldn't have come in, there was no harm involved. It was never used to insinuate that the appellant was attempting to harm the child or anything like that. It was just merely admitted to set the stage, set the scene, and it was relevant for that purpose, and relevant for the purpose of showing the state of mind, perhaps, of the parties involved.
Well, wasn't there evidence that the victim was on his way to the child's bedroom? Presumably, I guess the jury might infer that
to
protect his child?
Yes, the jury could infer that, and in fact, that could go to the state of the mind to refute the appellant's claim of self-defense in this case, in which he claimed that he thought perhaps Mr. Miles was attempting to grab him or assault him or something like that. Finally, with respect to the autopsy photograph, States 138 is a photograph of the deceased's liver. It has a metal rod through it that the medical examiner put there, and that photograph was admitted for the purpose of helping the medical examiner with his testimony, illuminating for the jury the nature of the injuries, and in particular, the trajectory of the bullet. And so while that photograph could probably be considered somewhat gruesome, it's more properly considered, I think, under the case law as a clinical kind of photograph that was highly relevant to and assist the medical examiner's testimony and assist the jury in understanding technical testimony that the medical examiner gave.
The theory being that if the trajectory was from he was up high, the defendant was, to the victim who was down lower, that would not support a self-defense theory.
That's accurate, Your Honor.
Okay. And that's what the evidence showed.
That would be what the state argued and believed that that's what the evidence showed. Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I'd like to take you back to the fourth issue with regards to the manslaughter charge.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very easy sometimes and very tempting to just brush off something and say, well, this is, even if this was error, it was harmless and didn't change the outcome of the case. I think that's all too tempting to jump there. Counsel for the appellant has made the argument that we have more than a scintilla of evidence here. It should have at least gotten a question to the jury based on the statements that his client made to the officers. Give me your best argument as to why there was not a scintilla of evidence and why that charge should not have been submitted.
Well, the best argument as to why that charge should not have been submitted, as to why there's not a scintilla of evidence, is that the appellant said to the police, well, I pulled out my gun, something I'm paraphrasing here, but he pulled out his gun and that first shot was an accident. Regardless of whether it was an accident, the fact of the matter is that he pulled it out, fired the weapon, and then he fired it three more times. And that's not merely making a jump to, well, he fired four times, and therefore it had to be intentional. What it shows is that the appellant acted quickly and with a conscious action during this exchange, which happened quickly. And the entire force of his defense was one of self-defense. And manslaughter was just simply not brought out by any other testimony. And so the argument as far as harm goes is that no rational juror would have convicted of manslaughter, especially given that we know they rejected the self-defense claim. With that, I thank the court for coming up to Denton, and the state prays that the judgment and sentence be affirmed and that no reversible error be found. Thank you.
By way of some brief rebuttal, I'd like to turn quickly to the point that my colleague, Mr. Whitten, was just talking about with regards to the manslaughter instruction and there not being a scintilla of evidence. And I believe the state's contention is basically since he shot four times, it shows an intentional act, and therefore there's no scintilla of evidence. But I would argue to the contrary, that the scintilla of evidence is my client telling the police, I did not intend to kill anyone. Manslaughter is a lesser because it's a lesser mens rea. We've got the knowing and intentional murder. We've got reckless manslaughter. So he's not denying any of those actions whatsoever. He indeed pulled a gun. He indeed shot and killed Miles.
So you're saying that any time a defendant tells the police officer, I didn't intend to kill anybody, that they're entitled to a manslaughter?
Absolutely. Yes, ma'am.
Anytime they utter those words.
I think so.
Despite the evidence that might be out there.
Yes, ma'am. And that, and from a prosecutor's standpoint, as a former prosecutor, if I've got a strong case, then great, let them argue that. I'm going to shoot it out of the water. But we're at least entitled to the instruction, because that's a scintilla of evidence, and that's all it takes under Hall. So we think he should have gotten that. But there's further cooperation. It's not just my client's statements. The defense called an expert witness, a crime scene forensic analyst, Jennifer June, who testified that she had looked through everything with regards to the crime scene and that there was nothing there that refuted my client's statements, that his version of events is backed up by what she saw in the crime scene. So there is some cooperation there. It's not just my client's words, but it's also what the detective said on the video as well, and Jennifer June's testimony about nothing in here really refutes what he's saying. There's no physical evidence to really refute that on the crime scene. And that was her testimony as well that was presented by defendant in his case in chief on guilt innocence. So we believe that that's there. And under the harm analysis, since this was a properly preserved jury charge issue, all the appellant needs to show is some harm. By being deprived of a lesser included offense instruction, he got there. He's denied that. It would have dropped the degree of offense, and he would have been in a different punishment range. So that right there shows that he's met his harm analysis. With regards to Mr. Hatz, it may have only been one or two questions regarding Mr. Hatz being dead shortly after the assault, but that error was compounded and the harm was compounded by the state's closing argument in punishment. The state stood up in closing argument, I'm quoting it in my brief, they said, what has Mr. Stanley done? He's killed someone. What did he do to Mr. Hatz? And that right there was them signaling to that jury, this is a killer. He's killed before. And that is a huge error. That compounded it tenfold. That's beyond just one little statement of, well, you know, Mr. Hatz, he died a few days later. No, that's a big insinuation.
But there was no objection.
I believe that objection had been properly preserved earlier on with regards to any testimony. I think they'd asked for a running objection. I'd have to double check, but I think they asked for a running objection regarding anything regarding Mr. Hatz dying.
Do you think there's a running objection that was granted in the record?
I believe so. I remember looking at preservation on that one for when I was drafting it. I'll go back and double check, but I'm pretty sure they asked for a running objection regarding anything with Mr. Hatz dying. I'll double check, and if I'm wrong, I apologize, but I'm pretty sure that that was there with a running objection. But that compounded the error right there. So we think that he's at least entitled to a new punishment trial based on the Hatz error, but he certainly should get a new trial with regards to guilt innocence as well. So he didn't get in. He only got one of his defensive issues. He didn't get defensive property. He didn't get any mitigation on his punishment instruction with sudden fashion. He didn't even get the lesser included manslaughter case, and it's clear that he presented at least a scintilla of evidence. So for all of those reasons, we think that the judgment should be vacated and the appellant should be granted a new trial. Thanks. Thank you all for coming today. Appreciate it.
Okay, the case of Stanley versus State of Texas has been submitted, and the attorneys are now free to go about your business.